We've been talking about artificial intelligence on the Little Wireless program forever, from the time when it was a hypothesis until now when it is ubiquitous. The voice behind your TomTom, the algorithm that determines how long a task should take on a factory floor and what ads you may or must see on social media. It's a concept that has come to mean different things, perhaps too many different things. But for many people, it is seen as a feat of humanity, objective and clever. My next guest argues otherwise, saying that if anything, AI is far from neutral and increasingly exploiting people and the environment. Her name is Kate Crawford, and she's been studying AI for nearly two decades, which seems unlikely given her youth. She's a research professor at USC Annenberg, a senior principal researcher at Microsoft, and holds a range of other posts. She's advised policymakers in the UN, the European Parliament, and even the White House, and she's written for mastheads including the New York Times and the Washington Post. She's also found time to release a new book, which I shall hold up because we are taping this segment, The Atlas of AI, Power, Politics and the Planetary Costs of Artificial Intelligence. Kate, welcome back. It's been a while.
It has been a while. It's such a pleasure to see you, Philip.
Let's get back to basics. You describe AI, or you talk about the promiscuity of the term. Please elaborate and give us a workable definition.
Well, of course, the term artificial intelligence has been around since 1956, since the Dartmouth Conference. And back then, AI was really seen as something very different to today. It was about symbolic logic and expert systems, about trying to, in essence, really map human capabilities and the mind into computers by following formal logic. And it wasn't really until the early 2000s that we see the shift to what is now called machine learning, which is a series of techniques that really do large-scale statistical modelling, looking at large aggregates of data to spot patterns, optimise and make predictions. But that is one way to think about AI that's very technical. And certainly in my work, what I do is suggest that that's far too narrow, that we actually need to look at AI as a much bigger system, at its sort of as a material system and as a social system.
You're a bit of a heretic in that you say artificial intelligence is neither artificial nor intelligent.
Absolutely. And that's because, you know, in my work, I've been tracing what it takes to actually make artificial intelligence in the broader sense, looking at the minerals and where they come from to actually create our devices like iPhones and Amazon Echoes, looking at how much energy it takes to drive these large-scale data systems. And also looking at the labor all throughout the supply chain, from people who are labeling these huge training data sets to people who are actually working in the factories to put things in boxes so they can arrive at our homes in two-day delivery. So in that way, by tracing the way in which AI depends on so many natural resources and labor and data, I think about it almost as the extractive industry of the 21st century, much in the way that, you know, mining was in the 18th and 19th century.
We'll explore this later with your riff on lithium, but what we're looking at depends on a much wider set of political and social structures than we usually think.
Exactly right. And that to me is the thing that's really different. If you ask somebody in the street, you know, what is AI? They might say, oh, it's Siri or it's Alexa or it's Google search algorithm or it's a Tesla autonomous vehicle. And if you ask trained machine learning computer scientists, they might say, oh, it's, you know, a series of neural nets that are actually doing this sort of large-scale data ingestion and pattern detection. And each one of these definitions, I think, is narrowing the horizon of how we understand these systems.
Kate, can I ask you a very personal question?
You may.
How does AI recognize a cat?
Well, this is, you know, this is certainly seen as one of the great achievements of AI in the last 15 years, is that we've seen technical systems be able to do sort of object detection. And so the way you do it is that you get thousands upon thousands of images of cats, generally scraped off the internet. So if you've ever taken a picture of a cat and put it up on the web, who knows, it's probably sitting in a training set right now. And you are then using that almost as ground truth, if you will, to create a model that can detect the shape and appearance of cats. So if it's presented with a new picture of a cat, it can say, okay, that's a cat and not a dog. Now, that's all well and good if you're detecting cats and dogs. It starts to get very complicated when you start to try and detect and classify human beings, which of course is something that AI systems do all the time.
Are you talking facial recognition technology?
That's one of many, but certainly facial recognition technology is the one that you hear the most about. And I think people feel it to be much more personal because it's our faces and, you know, we feel quite attached to those. But there are so many ways in which AI systems are categorizing you, from your patterns of spending to the things you click on to the things that you put on Twitter or Facebook or Instagram. But certainly facial recognition is one you might see every time you go into an airport or go into a shopping mall. Or in many cases, it's being used in even more, I'd say, sensitive areas like hiring and the criminal justice system and education.
Let's look at its use in increasing, ever-increasing surveillance. There is, of course, a long history of workers being surveilled. In the olden days, it was the foreman or the time and motion study. Now it's the computer.
And we can, of course, go back to the Ford factories and sort of the Pinkerton detectives. And I, in so many ways, I trace what's happening with AI being used as a tool in workplaces sort of back to those histories in Ford's factories and Taylor's studies of micromanagements of human bodies. It's trying to extract maximum efficiency and value out of how people do work. And what that looks like today is that, you know, there are AI systems that observe people as they're working, that take snapshots of their computer screens every 5 seconds to see if they're doing focused work or not. There are systems that will rank you compared to your other employees in real time. And of course, it's used in hiring. So one of the systems I've written about, this is one that's been used by multiple companies and is, again, really popular in the United States.
Well, we use it to select guests.
Oh, do you? Oh, yeah, I'm glad to know.
That's
why you're here.
Well, look, before...
Well, thank you.
Earlier in the program, I was talking to our guru on Matters American in Bruce Shapiro, and we were talking about the unexpected, or to me, unexpected outcome with Amazon in Alabama when, well, a huge number didn't bother to vote at all, but others, it seemed to me, voted against self-interest. Have you got a take on Amazon in Alabama?
I do. In fact, I just wrote a piece about this for the Washington Post. It was a vote that I was watching very closely. If we look at the experience of life working inside an Amazon fulfillment center, as they're called, it's a very difficult life. I've spent time inside one in New Jersey, one of the largest ones, in fact, that uses large amounts of robotics as well as human workers. And it's shocking. I mean, these are gigantic spaces full of sort of gliding bright orange Kiva robots, which sort of deliver these stacks of products that you might buy, yoga mats and bottles of detergent, whatever else you're ordering. And they're brought to human pickers who have to sort of put them in these sort of repeated motions into trays that then get packed into boxes. And when you see the experience of work, not only is it physically stressful, you know, I saw people with bandages and sort of support things wrapped around, you know, arms and knees. But also it's extraordinarily stressful because of the way in which algorithmic management is being deployed. So there's a thing called the picking rate. You have to match the rate in terms of how many objects you pick and store.
We well remember when there were lots of suicides in China.
Absolutely.
In these sorts of factories when people just couldn't cope.
That's right. And Foxconn, in terms of, you know, Foxconn, of course, being a central part of the supply chain for iPhones, for Apple, it was seen as something extreme. But of course, you know, what we're seeing in Amazon is that it's been taken to the next level. It has become this sort of very, very kind of desirable job across the US for people who really are just trying to find somewhere where they can get sort of sustained work. But the work is extremely stressful and difficult. And so, yes, many people thought a union would be one way to address this. But frankly, I mean, Amazon has been extremely anti-union. It's very clear about that and did a lot of campaigning around this vote. But that doesn't mean it's over.
Kate, there's so much discussion about robots taking jobs where you argue in the book, and I'll hold it up yet again, you argue in the book that the problem is that humans are being treated like robots.
Precisely. And I think this is why the focus on robots taking our jobs has really led us astray from looking at the ways in which AI is already being deployed in so many jobs and making the experience of work more and more alienating for workers and trying to, again, treat people as a sort of a mechanized system. You know, what's interesting about going inside one of Amazon's warehouses is that people are just there to do the sort of fiddly things that robots cannot. You know, they're there as the cheap connective tissue between the sort of robotic machinery and the boxes. And this is what we're seeing time and time again, is that whatever can be automated is being automated through AI systems, leaving these often quite banal tasks for human beings.
You cite a research of Professor Judy Wiseman, who's shown that young, mostly male, workaholic engineers with no families are building the software and tools that measure life on the factory floor. So they're the slave drivers, the slave masters' slaves.
Well, this is why it's important to look at who gets to decide what these systems will look like and who do they best serve. So if you look at the typical workforce of Silicon Valley, it's primarily men. Generally speaking, engineering workforces are between 85 to 90% male. They're often white men who come from very similar socioeconomic backgrounds, degrees in computer science and engineering. That produces this really kind of homogenous workforce that tends to assume that AI systems are trying to serve people that look like them.
Yeah.
And we see, again, these systems that tend to discriminate against anybody who looks different to that so-called standard norm.
When you were very young, I remember writing a column about the Mechanical Turk, that 18th century chess playing machine. It also played a very good game of cheese. That machine, the Mechanical Turk, appears in this book.
It does. I mean, it's interesting because, of course, the Mechanical Turk was this fantastic toast of the courts of Europe. It was really a sort of a mechanical box that had this sort of man with a turban, and it appeared to be a robot playing chess, and it could beat almost anyone. No one understood how it worked. Of course, it was a human chess master that was hidden within the mechanism, within a box inside a box, and it was a magic trick. And what was interesting was that when Jeff Bezos was realizing that to make Amazon work as a sort of distributed platform, he couldn't actually get machines to do the work. He needed people to double check what was happening with duplicate product pages. So he created, and I kid you not, he called it artificial intelligence. And guess what that is?
It's so people. He actually has a system called Mechanical Turk.
He calls it Mechanical Turk, and it's people, and it's a distributed labour force of Mechanical Turk workers who do very simple rote tasks, often for, you know, a few cents in an hour. It's very low paid work. It's, in some ways, you could think about it as the digital piecework for the 21st century. And that distributed workforce is used in so many of these sorts of tasks that we assume that AI can do, but actually it's people behind the scenes making these systems work.
As a technophobe, I knew very little about Bitcoin and was shocked to discover what a great hunger, appetite it has for power. And AI is also energy hungry.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. I mean, if you look at the sort of energy requirements to build these large-scale AI models, it's horrifying. Just before the pandemic, of course, data centers were neck and neck with the airline industry in terms of their carbon footprint. Right now, they've dramatically overtaken it. So certainly in terms of just the sort of raw energy requirements for the current sorts of AI systems that we're very familiar with today, they are so much more energy hungry than we think of. Mainly, I think, because people assume that tech is a green industry. It sounds so immaterial. It's in the cloud. It's, you know, abstract and it's mathematical. But in fact, the opposite is the case. I mean, these are very material technologies.
You've used green. Let's go to grey gold. Tell us about that.
Well, this is one of the things that I did for Atlas of AI, is that if I wanted to understand how artificial intelligence is made, I had to go to the places where its components are being constructed. And that meant going to the mines, where so many minerals, including sort of rare earth minerals, are being pulled out of the ground and turned into our consumer AI devices. So I got in a car and I drove through the American deserts to go to the last functioning lithium mine, which is out in Nevada, in a place called Silver Peak. And there in this sort of enormous desert landscape is this mine for lithium crystal. And lithium crystal, you know, it uses a few grams in an iPhone, but it uses many kilograms to do a single Tesla rechargeable battery. You need lithium ion for rechargeable batteries. They're very, you know, they don't sound very sexy, but it's a key part of how planetary computation works.
We mine some in WA, but it tends to be extracted in countries with very bad colonial histories, the likes of Bolivia, Congo, Indonesia.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. And of course, now we're seeing this sort of battle around rare earth between China and Australia, you know, China being the first sort of largest producer and we're number two. But by going to these sites, what I found really extraordinary was to see that sort of lithium has a very short lifespan. If we don't find new reserves of lithium and we don't get better at recycling it, we could be running out somewhere between 2040 and 2100. So seeing these sorts of mineral deposits as really at the end of life, and yet we're using them in these kind of disposable ways, you know, in phones and in Amazon Echoes that we tend to throw out every 3 or 4 years. So we're sort of extracting billions of years worth of time, the deep time of the planet, into this sort of brief moments of technological convenience.
When we asked AI to choose you for the program, it advised us that you raise a lot of concerns about technocratic power, and so we need to be asking all sorts of questions. It also said that you have some answers.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Albert Einstein, I believe, once said that if he was told that he had an hour to save the planet, that he would spend 55 minutes diagnosing the problem and 5 minutes coming up with a solution. So I think certainly in this book, I'm spending 55 minutes looking at the problem, which is to say, first of all, we have to stop thinking about AI as something that's abstract and neutral and immaterial, and we have to look at it as being profoundly drawing on limited natural resources, labor, and vast amounts of data. In terms of what we do about it, when we realize that essentially AI is centralizing power into fewer and fewer hands, then I think we have to move to questions about regulation. I mean, of course, this is an industry that has been remarkably unregulated for the last 15 years. And that is something that I think has to change in the next decade. But also, I'm interested in thinking about how, frankly, looking at civil society, looking at the extraordinary movements around climate justice and around labor rights and around data protection, issues that tend to be thought of very separately, are now coming together around this issue of artificial intelligence. So I think this is going to be one of the big civil rights issues of our time, which is how these systems can actually be centralizing so much power and producing, I think, such uneven results depending who you are and where you live, that this is something that we absolutely have to start prioritizing.
I suddenly realize I haven't given a guest a koala stamp for some time, and you've just won one. That's absolutely fascinating.
Thank you.
And that was none other than Professor Kate Crawford, co-founder of the AI Institute at New York University, a researcher at Microsoft, and holds a range of other posts, including research professor at USC Annenberg. She's the author of The Atlas of AI, Power, Politics, and the Planetary Costs of Artificial Intelligence. And I commend to you the quality of the dear little illustrations. It's published by Yale.